you might quite justifiably be excused after some 8 weeks in our studies of a class entitled Leviticus and Deuteronomy, if we're ever going to see Leviticus or Deuteronomy. So we have had a tremendous amount of introductory information in the 2 months that we've been building up into this introduction to the book of Leviticus. We have looked at the purpose of law in general, the nature really of all law. We have discussed in an entire class the purpose, particularly of the entire Old Testament, all its 39 books, but the purpose of Old Testament law. We have a class in about a half in which we dealt with a universal moral law that's mentioned in the Roman letter and is apparent throughout the Old Testament as well. Certain principles by which God accuses or excuses according to their own consciences, because we have an inherent knowledge of good and evil. We then, prior to the law of Moses, when there were no Jews and Gentiles, even before Abraham, you know, still yet had a sense of right and wrong. So we spent quite a bit of time recognizing that one does not need a written law in order to understand that there are some things that are right, some things that are wrong, and that we'll be answering for them. We then read over the first 7 chapters of the book of Leviticus. So we did have one night in which we were looking at the 5 main sacrificial offerings that are presented in those chapters. So tonight, in a little bit, after this introductory section, we're going to be picking up in Leviticus chapter 8, although I will be having a quick look at Exodus chapter 40 before we get into the actual study itself. But we've seen these first 7 chapters already and understand the book of Leviticus, named after the Levites and the Levitical priesthood, is a book concerned with these sacrifices, but not only those sacrifices. There's a tremendous amount of information there for these Levites, for these priests, about how that tabernacle is to function. We have looked at the nature of covenants in particular, a whole class just thinking what covenants are about, how they require sacrifice, and God entering into a new covenant with the establishment of this new priesthood and this new tabernacle and these new sacrifices that we're reading about in Leviticus. We also then last week had finished up our overview of these things by looking at the feasts and the calendar year of the Jews. Their entire lives will be caught up and controlled by their understanding through Moses and the priests of God in heaven, who has chosen them to be in a new covenant with a particular law that separates them from the rest of the world, to be served by priests who will offer various kinds of sacrifices on these various feast days so that these people might become a light to the world. Now, we have, as I said, pointed out the outline of Leviticus and have already looked at the five main sacrifices in those first 7 chapters. Tonight, we're going to be looking at the actual ordination of the priests, the establishment and the very first time that these sacrifices are being offered. So we'll be looking in chapters 8 through 10 in just a minute. And then we'll be moving on into chapters 11 through 15 and God's numerous distinctions between that which is clean and that which is unclean. Many of these things will just be fascinating to us. Some of them a bit befuddling, unique to the Jewish people and their relationship to God in these days. And then there is a 16th chapter about the Day of Atonement, a whole chapter devoted just to that one day where the high priest enters the Holy of Holies. And then chapters 17 through 26, you shall be holy, for I am holy, is the theme of those remaining chapters, and we'll just be continuing down through them as well. Leviticus is a book that is revealed by Moses to these people as God has revealed it to him at the beginning of the wilderness wanderings. Deuteronomy, which means second law, will be a rehearsal, a repetition of that law at the end of the 40 years of the wilderness wanderings. So we're starting in Leviticus, going to be looking at the establishment of this new religion, and then some 39 years later, thereabouts, we'll be seeing Moses recapping all of the wilderness wanderings and rehearsing with them again as they go into the promised land their laws. Now, as I said, please look into Exodus chapter 40 for just a moment. And we'll get this dating again. We did this once before, but I want to point it out one more time. In Exodus chapter 40 and verse 17, it came about in the first month of the second year. So one entire exactly year since they've left Egypt. It came about in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was what? It was finished, and it was assembled, and it became a freestanding thing that was now open for business. It is ready so that this newly explained priesthood can now be set in place and begin to function as priests before their God. So that's Exodus 40 and verse 17. There is, of course, obviously some more information that finishes out that chapter. But when you end the book of Exodus and begin the book of Leviticus, there is no break. In fact, verse 1 of chapter 1 in Leviticus says, "Then the Lord called to Moses, spoke to him from the tent of meeting." So these first seven chapters about these five primary sacrifices, we've already read about them some few weeks ago, but this information has been revealed to Moses and is now being explained to these people on this day, the first day of the first month of their second year, on the day when the tabernacle, according to Exodus 40 and verse 17, has just been set in place. It's finished. It stands and it's ready for what now is about to happen. So, we've already read over the nature of God, Moses introducing these people to their five sacrifices. Perhaps, at the end of chapter 7, if you didn't back in that preceding class, I'd recommend it now. You might make a list at the end of chapter 7, and just, you know, as a summary, chapter 1 was the burnt sacrifice. Chapter 2 was the grain sacrifice. Chapter 3 was the peace sacrifice or offering. Chapters 4 and 6 were the sin sacrifice or sin offering. Chapter 5 is the guilt offering. And then, here in chapter 7, that guilt offering, you know, is continuing. You can see that it's a guilt offering in chapter 7 in verse 1. Apparently, brethren, we are now coming quite chronologically on a single day through the bestowal of a great deal of information to these people as we prepare now to ordain the priests to offer the sacrifices which have just been rehearsed and introduced to these people in these first seven chapters. So in verse 1 of chapter 8, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take Aaron and his sons with him, and the garments, and the anointing oil, and the bull of the sin offering, and the two rams, and the basket of unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting." Now you recall, as we've been coming along and thinking about sacrifices and feast days and various activities, there was another word for assembly that's been used quite a bit. What's that other word? Starts with a C. A convocation. So that's a word we don't use a whole lot these days. Assembly is more familiar to us. But it is a convocation. It is an assembly. So we have a very formal meeting now. All of these very many people that have been one full year out of Egypt now are assembled there in front of the curtained enclosure, inside of which is the tabernacle itself, with behind the curtains its holy place and then Holy of Holies.
So the Lord now says to Moses, Moses, I want you to take Aaron over there and his sons. By the way, how many sons does Aaron have when we open up in chapter 8? He's got four. Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These four. So take Aaron and his sons with him, the garments and the anointing oil, the bull of the sin offering, the two rams, the basket of the unleavened bread, and assemble all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So Moses did just as the Lord commanded him. When the congregation was assembled at the door of the tent of meeting, Moses said to the congregation, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded to do." So he informs the people, "Watch me now. God," remember the terrifying mountain. I was up there six different times, and once I took some elders with me as well. In fact, Aaron's boys went with me too, and Aaron. And so you remember, we've had all this going on. We've been building ever since to get this tabernacle ready. In verse 6, this is what, or 5, this is what the Lord commanded to do now. In 6, Moses had Aaron and his sons come near, washed them with water. He put the tunic on him, on Aaron, and girded him with the sash. So I put up what I deem to be likely the most accurate representation of what the high priest's clothing might look like on the screen. And as we're reading now these next verses down through verse 9, you can refer to this as you like. I know you won't be able to read this at the bottom, so let me do it for you. It's small, but it says, "Each temple vessel restored by the Temple Institute is kosher for use in the soon-to-be-rebuilt Third Temple, made according to the exact requirements and specifications of biblical law. Please donate generously to help the sacred work of the Temple Institute. Every contribution helps to rebuild the Holy Temple in our time." I just stumbled across the Temple Institute there in Jerusalem, second trip back in 2017. I was just stunned and amazed. I'd heard about it, but I'd never been there and I'd never gone inside where they have a great museum. These are people, of course, quite terribly mistaken, but nonetheless, these are people who believe that any day now, the old Jewish religion, since the Messiah in their views never come, the old Jewish religion is going to be reborn. Like nobody else I know, these people appear to have really been studying their Old Testament for years and years and years, and have done what I deem at least to be the best possible, you know, that you can hope for in reconstructing from these descriptions what absolutely each and every utensil and garment and everything that goes into the sacrifices as described in the Old Testament. They have gone through, studied that thing to the nth degree, and then built them. So you can go into the museum and see the life-sized, every instrument that you read about in the Old Testament. They've got it all ready. They're begging for your money, because they think any day now they're going to defeat the Muslims, cast them off the Temple Mount, rebuild their temple, and then there's going to be a new high priest, and all of this is going to take place again. So, obviously, don't know a thing about their Bibles, they're completely mistaken, but they sure have studied out the best they can those Old Testament descriptions. So I use their material here, as I think it's at least as accurate as you're likely to see. Bill, do you have a hand up? Well, as a matter of fact, when I was there in 2017, there was only one other guy that was there at the moment I happened to go in. So I went through the whole tour, you know, with him. It's a self-guided thing. It's got recordings and whatnot. He believed himself to be in Aaron's line and was hoping that he might be one of the priests. So he was a very fascinating character to talk to. You meet the most interesting people in Jerusalem. So all I can say to you is, you know, it is impossible. But like the Jews of old, did that ever bother them that they were doing things that you couldn't read about in the Scriptures while all the time saying that they're only doing what the Scriptures teach?
So they've got their theories, and I can't explain to you exactly how. You need to come with me this year, Bill, and we'll march right in there and we'll ask that question. But somehow they think they've figured it out, so I don't know what it is. But at any rate, it can't be done. Still yet, this high priest, as we're reading this description, is going to look something like this. So, in verse 7, he put the tunic on him, girded him with the sash, clothed him with the robe, put the ephod on him, girded him with the artistic band of the ephod, with which he tied it to him. He then placed the breastpiece on him, and in the breastpiece he put the Urim and the Thummim. He also placed the turban on his head, and on the turban at its front he placed the golden plate, the holy crown, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, you can't see it very well at all, and I don't know why they decided, you know, put it there on top of the guy's foot, but they've got the crown, you know, right here. But here's the turban, you know, as well. You can see that piece. So, now, this is very elaborate garb. It has precious stones, 12 of them that are on the face of this. There is the ephod. There is the Urim and Thummim by which somehow decisions were made, divine decisions were made, slipped inside some sort of pocket there behind those stones. We don't really quite understand how any of that was done, nor do these people from the Temple Institute, because as I've said so many times, it is quite apparent, and we're told in Exodus, that God had craftsmen that he had inspired to be involved in the creation of everything that has just been erected in preparation for a now fully functional religion of Moses' law. And so, today, without those people and without that direct inspiration, the text is insufficient to recreate all of this, you know, by itself. You just can't do it with only the text. This, I believe, certainly was God's intent all along. This religion was not intended to last forever. It certainly was not intended to last after 70 AD. It cannot be recreated today. We can get an inkling, and these guys are doing as good as anybody, but it's absolutely, Bill, you know, impossible on many different levels to be able to get this thing up and running again. It'll never happen. Carol. There's just so many things wrong with this idea, you know, isn't there? It just, the sacrifices, the calendar, you know, you take it, everything. You know, this religion just cannot work ever again. And why should it? The Messiah did come. Their fundamental flaw in their thinking, of course, is that he didn't. And so we're very interested in all of this because we've learned, and I took you back to all of, you know, Hebrews 9 and 10, and we read every word in both chapters. We saw how God was teaching the people about high priests, about the need for priests, about the need for sacrifice, all with a view to Jesus coming to fulfill then what were the shadows and the types of the Old Testament. So for these 1500 years of Moses' law, we have examples and illustrations, we have rudimentary teachings that are all ultimately pointing to their fulfillment in Jesus the Christ. So, these are the first 9 verses. And now this man is here, fully garbed and ready, you know, to get going with this new religion. Now, somebody's pointing over here. Was it Greg? Did you have your hand up? I never saw it. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say that a lot of people who believe that Jesus was the Christ, and did come, they believe that there will be a third temple built.
Yeah, exactly. These are pure, quote-unquote, Jews. But Greg, of course, is quite right. We've still got an awful lot of premillennialists who think that there is going to be another temple, too. They would agree with these guys, think Jesus is coming back in the flesh. Well, that's for another day, you know, but of course, you know, not any kind of truth in it. The good news in our time is that premillennialism is really wasting away. It was profoundly popular, you know, starting in the 1800s, throughout the whole 20th century. It has failed so many times and made a joke and caricature out of itself that while we used to have to deal with it all the time, you know, premillennialism now is just on the wane. You know, because nobody can really sustain it anymore. So plenty of people out there still believe it, but not nearly as many as used to. It's just failed too cataclysmically. So Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, and so many others, Baptists included, you know, are all having just problems recognizing that it's just not working. Okay, so be that as it may, though, the next thing that happens is in Leviticus chapter 8, verses 10 through 13. This is totally unrelated to the Temple Institute people. Once again, I thought it was a pretty good artist rendition here. We have Moses, who is about now to ordain Aaron as the high priest, with his sons in attendance. They too will be ordained for their duties. Other priests are also present on this day, the first day of the second year, 1 year to the day after they left Egypt. So we'll be reading now verses 10 through 13. Moses then took the anointing oil and anointed the tabernacle and all that was in it, and consecrated them. He sprinkled some of it on the altar seven times, and anointed the altar and all its utensils. So if you go to the Temple Institute, you can see all those utensils are best they think anyway they should have looked. And the basin and its stand, it's where the water was with which Aaron and his sons were washed, to consecrate them. Then he poured some of the anointing oil on Aaron's head and anointed him to consecrate him. Next, Moses had Aaron's sons come near and clothed them with tunics and girded them with sashes and bound caps on them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. But once again, you can go back to Exodus. There's chapter after chapter after chapter in that last half where in great detail all these utensils in various parts of the tabernacle are being built and described. So we can go back, you know, you can find more information on all that. But we've covered that as intensively, at least as I intend to. So that then brings us to verse 14 in chapter 8. Then he brought the bull of the sin offering. Well, that was chapters 4 and 6 that Moses had just told the people about. So in 14, he brought the bull of the sin offering, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the bull of the sin offering. Next, Moses slaughtered it. This is an amazing day. Moses is like nobody else in this new religious system. Moses is their law giver. He receives it from the hand of God. 10 of the commandments are carved in stone by the finger of God. He then comes down the mountain with those tablets, and he is given a tremendous amount more information, which he's writing down, and we're finding now in this book, for instance. But at this outset, we don't have a priest yet. So who kills the first sacrificial animal? The lawgiver. Moses kills that first sin offering. He does the slaughtering. And he's going to do a lot more as these next few hours unfold in this fateful day. In verse 15, Moses slaughtered it and took the blood and with his finger put some of it around on the horns of the altar. Remember, we talked about those horns. And purified the altar. Then he poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar and consecrated it to make atonement for it. That to me is an odd word to use for an inanimate object. What sin could it, you know, possibly have committed? And I, you know, and of course it has not committed any sin. But in a very distinctive and attention-getting ceremony, everything that will be associated with this tabernacle and its sacrificial worship system must be set apart and dedicated to God. And you can't cleanse anything, say wood and clay, you know, without blood. So everything is going to have blood applied to it, and Moses is going to be, as the lawgiver, the first to do this. In verse 16, Moses also took all the fat that was on the entrails and the lobe of the liver. We're cutting deeply into this animal now. And the two kidneys and their fat, and Moses offered it up in smoke on the altar. Who killed the animal? Who cut it up? Who dug its organs out?
Who put it on the fire of the altar the first time? Moses does. 17. But the bull and its hide, and its flesh and its refuse, he burned in the fire outside the camp, just as the Lord had commanded Moses back in chapters 4 and 6. I find it helpful here, you know, I made that list at the end of chapter 7. Now, as I'm reading about this ordination, I'm seeing these various sacrifices go by. I've got that handy list there, you know, I hope you put it down there too. And so now, in we've read about that in these earlier 7 chapters. In verse 18, then he presented the ram of the burnt offering. That was chapter 1 of this book. And Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. And Moses slaughtered it and sprinkled its blood around on the altar. When he had cut the ram into pieces, Moses offered up the head and the pieces and the suet in smoke. After he had washed the entrails and the legs with water, Moses offered up the whole ram in smoke on the altar. It was a burnt offering for a soothing aroma. It was an offering by fire to the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses in chapter 1, which we read a couple of weeks ago. 22. Then he presented the second ram, the ram of ordination. And Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. Now you see, that's the third time we've had Aaron and his sons laying their hands on an animal. We had a bull and now these two rams. So I've kept that particular artist, you know, drawing up there. We have a very intense ceremony going on. We have these men getting ready for service. And in three times now, they've laid their hands on this animal. There is symbology now of our sins, our impurity, our failures, our degradation, our pollution being placed upon the animal. After which, immediately, what happens to the animal? Moses kills it, cuts it up, digs its organs out, starts burning it on the altar and sprinkling its blood around hither and yon. So in 23, Moses slaughtered it, this now the ram of ordination, took some of its blood and put it on the lobe of Aaron's right ear, on the thumb of Aaron's right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. Now, brethren, at this point, you know, I suppose most people are tempted to giggle a little even. You know, you're thinking, what is this about? No further explanation is given. All I could do is speculate, and that isn't worth anything. You know, I just know that this is what God wanted Moses to do. I'm pretty sure, had I been, you know, a Levite, and somebody was having me lay my hands on this animal, kill this animal so that I can be purified, and then take its blood and put it on my ear and on my thumb and on my toe, I would feel like every part of me, my head, my hands, and my feet, have somehow been set apart by the sacrificial loss of this animal's life. Its blood is on me. It would be a very sobering experience. But why God did that, you know, and why not the left side, and why not the nose, you know, I don't know. I can't answer these questions. Nobody can. And that's another reason why none of this can be resurrected here today. But it would sure catch your full attention if you were such a person at this moment. And so then, in 24, he also had Aaron's sons come near. Moses put some of the blood on the lobe of their right ear, on the thumb of their right hand, on the big toe of their right foot. Moses then sprinkled the rest of the blood around on the altar. He took the fat and the fat tail and all the fat that was on the entrails and the lobe of the liver and the two kidneys and their fat and the right thigh. And from the basket of unleavened bread that was before the Lord, he took one unleavened cake and one cake of bread mixed with oil and one wafer, placed them on the portions of fat and on the right thigh. He then put all of these on the hands of Aaron and on the hands of his sons and presented them as a wave offering before the Lord. Then Moses took them from their hands and offered them up in smoke on the altar with the burnt offering. They were an ordination offering, a soothing aroma. It was an offering by fire to the Lord. Moses also took the breast and presented it for a wave offering before the Lord. It was Moses' portion of the ram of ordination, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. This is going to come up again a little later in our reading tonight. But portions of these sacrifices are not entirely consumed by the fire. They will be reserved for the priests and for Moses and are to be eaten. And then even specifications on how they're to be eaten and what can be left over, nothing, you know, is stipulated. But we've had twice now in this last reading, you know, a wave offering introduced. And again, nobody's quite sure what this means. We think it means that you bring whatever this particular sacrifice is, you then cut it all up into these bloody pieces that we've been talking about, and then you take this piece. And we're guessing, but you know it's a reasonable guess, that then you elevate it toward God, and a wave offering would obviously bend some motion like this, perhaps. As opposed to a heave offering, which would be what? Apparently, you know, lifted vertically while the other is somehow rocked back and forth before the Lord. That's the best that we know. We don't have Moses to explain. We no longer have a priesthood. We're not sure. We don't know why. But it would sure get your full attention. God is requiring an extremely elaborate, very graphic, you know, loss of life and presentation of these dead meat pieces in various manners before Him. You are getting a sense that it requires an awful lot of blood to come into the presence of the Lord. Which brings us now to verses 30 through 36. So Moses took some of the anointing oil and some of the blood which was on the altar and sprinkled it on Aaron, on his garments, on his sons, on the garments of his sons with him, and he consecrated Aaron, his garments, and his sons, and the garments of his sons with him. And Moses said to Aaron and to his sons, boil the flesh at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Eat it there together with the bread, which is in the basket of the ordination offering, just as I commanded, saying, Aaron and his son shall eat it. Go back in the first seven chapters and you'll find that information. 32. The remainder of the flesh and of the bread you shall burn in the fire. You shall not go outside the doorway of the tent of meeting for 7 days until the day that the period of your ordination is fulfilled. For he will ordain you through 7 days. The Lord has commanded to do as has been done this day to make atonement on your behalf. At the doorway of the tent of meeting, moreover, you shall remain day and night for 7 days. Keep the charge of the Lord that you may not die, for so I have been commanded. Then Aaron and his sons did all the things which the Lord had commanded through Moses. So now they're taking portions of these sacrifices. They are going to be standing, well, it's not in this picture, no, but outside of this enclosure for a boiling and an eating. And then they're be in the doorway of the tent of meeting. Now, this next illustration, I know as we're reading through Leviticus 9, maybe not as clear as some of the others, but there was some way in which the curtains at the front here, you know, could be parted or lifted or somehow open so the priest could pass through. This is the doorway of the tent of meeting. And so where are these priests going to be now for the next week? They're not allowed to go home. Is there any shelter here? There's no shelter at all. For 7 days, what do they have to do? Apparently, just lie on the ground. They can't leave that immediate area. Why? They are now dedicated to whom? If you're going to be dedicated to God, then what happens to your own concerns back home? They are meaningless. They are not to even be contemplated. And if it's uncomfortable, if it's inconvenient, if it would be, I think, terribly and miserably uncomfortable, nonetheless, this is an honor to which God has called you. He is holy
Be ye holy as he is holy. He is God. You are man. You must be cleansed. You must be prepared for service. And you must be warned. Do what God says or what? Die. God is not going to take anybody's foolishness on this of all days. Now, Leviticus 9, we can read rather quickly. And in fact, I doubt I'll even stop. Let's just read the whole thing. It came about on the eighth day. So now these priests have been there for these 7 days. Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel, and he said to Aaron, take for yourself a calf, a bull for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering. Where can you go read about sin offerings, ram offerings? You know, the first 7 chapters, you know, we did it. So now we get it, according to the instructions, it's 8 days now have passed, come do this. Without defect, continue verse 2, and offer them before the Lord. Then to the sons of Israel you shall speak, saying, take a male goat for a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, both 1 year old without defect, for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for peace offerings to sacrifice before the Lord, and a grain offering mixed with oil. For today the Lord shall appear to you. We'll spend 7 days just getting ready. They must be trembling. Verse 5. So they took what Moses had commanded to the front of the tent of meeting, and the whole congregation came near and stood before the Lord. Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you. Moses then said to Aaron, come near to the altar, offer your sin offering and your burnt offering, that you may make atonement for yourself and for the people. Then make the offering for the people, that you may make atonement for them, just as the Lord has commanded. 8. So Aaron came near to the altar, slaughtered the calf of the offering. Who's killing animals now? Moses is done. We have a new priesthood. They've spent 7 days here at the doorway being consecrated. They're ready now for their service. So in verse 8, Aaron came near. He slaughtered the calf of the sin offering, which was for himself. Aaron's sons presented the blood to him. He dipped his finger in the blood and put some on the horns of the altar and poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar. The fat and the kidneys and the lobe of the liver of the sin offering he then offered up in smoke on the altar, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. The flesh and the skin, however, he burned with fire outside the camp. Does this sound like chapter 8 when Moses was doing all this? Yes, indeed. But it's not Moses now. It's the priest doing the same things with the same sacrifices. 12. Then he slaughtered, Aaron did, the burnt offering, and Aaron's sons handed the blood to him, and he sprinkled it around on the altar. They handed the burnt offering to him in pieces with the head, and he offered them up in smoke on the altar. He also washed the entrails and the legs, offered them up in smoke with the burnt offering on the altar. Then he presented the people's offering, took the goat of the sin offering, which was for the people, and slaughtered it, offered it for sin like the first. He also presented the burnt offering and offered it according to the ordinance. Next, he presented the grain offering and filled his hand with some of it and offered it up in smoke on the altar besides the burnt offering of the morning. Then he slaughtered the ox and the ram, the sacrifice of peace offerings, which was for the people and Aaron's sons, handed the blood to him. He sprinkled it around on the altar. As for the portions of fat from the ox and from the ram, the fat tail, the fat covering the kidneys, the lobe, the liver, they now placed the portions of fat on the breasts, and he offered them up in smoke on the altar. But the breasts and the right thigh Aaron presented as a wave offering before the Lord, just as Moses had commanded. Then Aaron lifted up his hands toward the people, blessed them. He stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering. Stepped down from where? How does a priest approach the altar? Barefoot and on a ramp. Remember? So he comes up the ramp, he offers all this. Now he steps down. He's turned back from the altar, he's come back down, you know, to the ground level. So, he lifted 22, he stepped down, 23, Moses and Aaron went in to the tent of meeting. When they came out and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Then fire came out from before the Lord
and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Now, I'm guessing then somehow, brethren, these curtains had to have been pulled back. Moses and Aaron have actually gone in, apparently, to the holy place. They've come back out. Fire comes down from God in the presence of, lo, these many people. They all see the sacrifice consumed by divine fire from above. Throw themselves on the ground. Are you impressed? Who's in charge here? Are you glad you got the sacrifices offered to cleanse you? Are you glad you spent those 7 days with blood on your earlobe and your thumb and your toe? Are you glad you didn't in any way change what God said to do? Because you've just seen God appear before you. I accept your sacrifice. And off it's gone. So now, apparently, brethren, I think we miss this always. You know, we always leap down into chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu. Okay, what day is it? It's the eighth day of the second year. What day is it? It's the first day the priests are offering sacrifices. They have been ordained. In the very presence of God, it's just appeared and consumed everything. Apparently, there's no break that I can find in the text. It's not days later. It's not independently. It's on the very day they were ordained that Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. This is the same day that they've just been ordained, apparently. And already, though, these two boys have taken it upon themselves to what? In the very presence of God's fiery acceptance of this sacrifice, what's the next thing Nadab and Abihu do? They offer what we sometimes refer to as will worship. That is, worshiping God in accordance with my will and not His. This is the world we live in today. It's the world we've always lived in. The reason there's so many, you know, religions is because of will worship. Dissatisfied with what God tells us now in our New Testaments, even as Nadab and Abihu apparently were with the Old Testament restrictions, people make up their own ways of worshiping the Lord. And by the way, remember my high priest picture. I go online, I'm looking for pictures of high priest, you know, I'm trying to hunt down the best stuff that I can find for you. And, you know, and I saw lots of people that had various, you know, ideas on what this garb looked like. One of them was some guy standing in a church building, big collection of instruments, you know, drum set and guitars and everything over here in the corner, you know, and here's this guy standing there. You know, and what it looks like to me is just such a sacrilegious thing. You know, will worship. They're in some church today, worshiping God in a manner that he's never asked for. And here they are dressed in the very garb on the day, you know, that we have the premier example of how wrong that is. It was just an amazing sight for me to see. So, Nadab and Abihu, brethren, these boys are way out of line. And the only line they crossed was they decided to do something that God had not commanded. Not a thing that God had forbidden. They just decided to add something. So they didn't, nobody could accuse them of doing something God had forbidden. What they did was something God had not commanded. Where should we draw the line in all things, brethren? Where God does. It's not ours to make a new religion. It's ours to adhere to His, now of course, under New Testament direction. So, in verse 2, fire came out from the presence of the Lord, apparently a second time after that altar or sacrifice had been consumed, and it consumes them. They died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aaron, therefore, kept silent as he what? As he stands over his two dead sons.
He has been instructed. May he mourn. May he weep. May he show any sense of grief. It is forbidden him, and why? Who is he dedicated to? He is dedicated to God. And this is forbidden him, and it doesn't matter whose bodies he's looking at. So he says nothing. And then Moses called also to Mishael and Elzaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle, Aziel, and said to them, come forward, carry your relatives away from the front of the sanctuary to the outside of the camp. So they came forward, carried them, still in their tunics, to the outside of the camp, as Moses had said. Again, it's always such a marvel to me. And I go looking for the death of Nadab and Abihu. Now, I like this one a lot. Once they're dead, what are they still in to be carried out with? Their tunics. But you should have seen how many of these pictures people paint. Their clothes are all on fire and smoked up and everything. The passage specifically says the clothing, the tunics, which had been dedicated to God, you know, for the priests and all that, were not burnt up. So they came, the cousins, and they take them, still in their tunics, verse 10, outside the camp as Moses had said. 6. Then Moses said to Aaron and to his sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, do not uncover your heads, a sign of grieving, nor tear your clothes, a sign of grieving, so that you may not die, and that he may not become wrathful against all the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, lest you die. For the Lord's anointing oil is upon you. So they did according to the word of Moses. What a moment in biblical history. What an awesome moment. How many witnesses do we have? The whole of Israel is gathered at the doorway of the tent of meeting. They've seen the presence of God consume the offering from the altar. And then they've seen that fire or whatever it was descend again. And Nadab and Abihu keel over dead and have to be carried outside the camp like any other filth that defiles the people and the camp. They're just taken out like refuse, like garbage. Off they go. And then the family, who are priests, are told, you may not mourn in any way, shape, or form. Imagine that moment if it's happening to you. The father who may not grieve for his sons. The two brothers who yet live and will now take the places of the two that yet just died. Just think of this moment. Has God impressed these people that you're going to do it his way or else? Yes. So, in verse 9, remember they can't even leave the doorway of the tent of meeting, so there they are. In verse 9, a statement is made, in addition to, I will be treated as holy and I will be honored. That leads many to suspect, at least what may have been involved in the failure of Nadab and Abihu. But so far as I can tell, brethren, there's no way to know for sure. So we just learn in verse 9, do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you may not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean. And so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moses. If you want to ask my opinion, I don't see any direct connection between this prohibition against the use of alcohol, you know, by the priests, and Nadab and Abihu. A lot of people do. They think, well, he must have gotten drunk then. Well, maybe so. I mean, that is maybe so. But what this is all about is God's impressing these people. I will be honored. And when you do anything that I haven't told you to do, that is will worship. That is you deciding how you think worship ought to be done and not following my commands. I will not have it.
And I'm not going to have anybody coming inebriated before me. If you can't recognize that you better be sober in my presence, you know, then you deserve what you get, which is instantaneous death. So, in the day of the ordination, apparently, we had a bunch of animals that died. We had two of Aaron's sons, his first and second born, by the way, who die and are carried out like awful. And then, you know, we have these statements. You better honor me. So then in 12, by the way, in 11 it says, and so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord spoken to them through Moses. I can't see again why alcohol would be denied the teachers. You know, when you're intoxicated, you're not a very good teacher. You're likely to make mistakes. This God will not tolerate. So in 12, Moses spoke to Aaron and to his surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. Take the grain offering that's left over from the Lord's offerings by fire. Eat it, unleavened, beside the altar, for it is most holy. You shall eat it moreover in a holy place, because it is your due and your son's due out of the Lord's offerings by fire, for thus I have been commanded. The breast of the wave offering, however, and the thigh of the offering you may eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you. For they've been given as your due, and your sons due out of the sacrifices of the peace offerings of the sons of Israel. The thigh offered by lifting up, and the breast offered by waving, there's your heave and your wave, they shall bring along with the offerings by fire of the portions of fat to present as a wave offering before the Lord. So it shall be a thing perpetually due you and your sons with you, just as the Lord has commanded. But Moses searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up. So he was angry with Aaron's surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, saying, why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? It is most holy. He gave it to you to bear away the guilt of the congregation and to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, since his blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary just as I commanded. But Aaron spoke to Moses, behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord. When things like these happen to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord? And when Moses heard that, it seemed good in his sight. I will accept Moses' judgment and freely admit that I don't understand it. Okay? There was something about all these circumstances, I'm guessing, that what you eat of these sacrifices is to be eaten in gladness and joy and gratitude. Okay, with the loss of two sons and then four two brothers, you know, how what state would you be in? You know, and I'm maybe that's involved somehow. I don't know. But they messed up twice this day. Yet the second time, Moses understood a rationale that is accepted apparently by him and by God. Aaron was right, but we don't understand how or why. So all I, you know, can do is speculate, and again, it doesn't do any good. So I just have to leave that with you. One mistake was a death penalty. The other one was understood as acceptable by God. That's all we know. So we accept God's judgment. Okay, so we're going to end tonight. Any comment or question? Great. Class dismissed.